This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Lots of TV programs are popular, but there's an interesting distinction between cop dramas and sitcoms and shows that see television as the final frontier. Star Trek, X-Files, Xena, Buffy. These are the programs that run people's lives. Their continuing plot lines explore strange new worlds and seek out new devotion from hardcore fans to go boldly beyond the series as no one has before. Their loyal fans not only watch every week, but discuss, debate, and even dress up. Collectively, it is called cult television. These are stories that hold the attention of millions for years, even decades. So, what is the attraction? Why do otherwise sensible adults immerse themselves so deeply in imaginary worlds? Later in the program, we'll look at another medium with a growing fan base, internet animation sites. But first, cult television. We'll look into the whys, hows, and whos of the shows that make it off the small screen and into the subculture. Our guests include Joss Whedon, the creator of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and other series, and genre TV star Bruce Campbell. And we want to hear from you. If you're a fan of one or more of these programs, why are they so important to you, and what makes for a good one? If you're mystified, what are your questions? What do you want to know? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or email us, TOTN at NPR.org. And joining us now is Roberta Pearson. She's the editor of a new book, Cult Television, a reader in media and cultural studies at Cardiff University. And she joins us now from there in Wales. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
Let's start with an argument we've been having here.
Hello?
Excuse me, just a cough there.
Okay.
Why is Star Trek a cult show and not, say, The Simpsons?
That's a very good question. In fact, it's something that we do try to address in the introduction to the book. I think you did put your finger on it when you talked about the intensity of devotion and the imaginary worlds that are created. And one of the often cited markers of cult television is people's desire to extend the imaginary universes that they're inhabiting through their own writing of fan fiction. And while many programs do, in fact, elicit fan fiction, I'm not quite sure if The Simpsons does, but certainly Star Trek does that. And it also, as you said, causes people to have role-playing games, to go to conventions, to really try to continue that experience that they get on the screen.
So it's not simply, you know, generating a lot of catchphrases like, you know, dough or yada, yada, yada. It's a lot more than that.
Well, I think certainly there is. I mean, there's a phrase that's used, sort of a good soundbite for journalists, the Roddenberry vision, that harkens back to Gene Roddenberry, who
sure.
was the creator, as it were. It sounds a bit SF in and of itself, doesn't it?
Yes, indeed.
But, I mean, what he managed to do with Star Trek was to create a universe that offered hope for people, and he managed also to create a fully realized universe, a universe where there were various alien cultures, where there were protocols of Starfleet, a universe that could be fully inhabited by people, I think, and that at the same time offered one of the very few visions, hopeful visions of the future from the genre of science fiction. And I think that's very, very important. And I think different cult television programs do that in different ways. For example, Buffy appeals certainly to young people because it's very much it's about the traumas of being a teenager. It's about growing up. And so what these supposed cult shows do is in fact connect in very real and direct ways with the circumstances of people's lives.
It's interesting. You called Gene Roddenberry the creator and argue that though there were precursors, in a lot of ways Star Trek was the originator of cult television, but that it came really in what you call TV1. And that you have to be careful about how the mechanisms by which these programs are distributed is extremely important.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, if I can put in a plug for the future, the next book out is going to be about Star Trek alone, and we'll very much address that issue, that in fact the existence of cult television has to do with a major transformation of the American television industry, that the original Star Trek was infamously canceled just a few days before Apollo 11 landed on the moon. And that was because at that point the networks were simply interested in numbers with regard to ratings, and Star Trek had always been fairly lowly rated, even though there were write-in campaigns from the fans to save the show. In the 1960s, 1970s and increasingly in the 80s, there was the notion of niche marketing, where demographics became much more important. And so it became more important to have the key demographic audiences, say the 18 to 49-year-old males, the people with the disposable income. And it's those people that the cult television shows are particularly going after. It also has to do, as you suggest, with some other transformations about technology, that if you have VCRs and increasingly DVDs, it permits you to collect these shows, to watch them repeatedly, which are very much part of being a cult television fan. I think it's also important to say, though, that there's a great deal of emphasis upon the cult TV fan, and there's certainly a great deal of caricature and even ridicule of the Trekkie and various other people. But there are a lot of other people who are general audience people, who are millions and millions of people actually watch these shows, and they're not all what would be seen as the hardcore fan. And in some ways, I think too much attention has been paid to the hardcore fan, and that's in fact one of the things we're trying to correct a bit in this book.
One of the things, though, about Star Trek that I think everybody remembers, after it was canceled, it went on to live in reruns forever and ever, and of course on and on, and will probably forever after. And so that enabled people to try to figure out that, look, you can make a program that costs a lot of money to make because of all the special effects and all of that, and make the money in reruns.
Yeah, indeed, that's the case. I mean, the economics of the television industry is that the costs that are paid to the producer in no way cover the costs of making the show. And so it's in syndication that you make your money. And that's why television shows have to run for, it's varied over the years, but you have to run for 4 or 5 years mm-hmm. in order to build up enough episodes to be syndicated. And that's absolutely crucial. So with Star Trek, it's become 7 years. The Buffy ran for 7 years. I think Xena was on for fewer than that. Mm-hmm. But syndication is tremendously important, yeah.
Let's have some listeners join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go to John, and John's with us from Denver, Colorado.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I owned my geekness long ago by liking shows like The Twilight Zone, Star Trek, and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I'm 33, so I'm in that total demographic. But I have to just raise one point. I disagree that these are absolutely fantasy shows. They tend to be better written than most shows, and they tend to be very heavily symbolic and representative of our natural world. But I just wanted to make that comment, and I'll take the answer off the air.
Roberta Pearson?
Oh, I'm in absolute agreement. That's what I'm talking about. That's exactly what I'm saying. These shows are tremendously serious, and in fact, because they're perceived as fantasy, as cult, they're allowed a certain latitude, I think, that I must say that is often not allowed within the American media in particular. There's a wonderful episode of Star Trek Voyager which deals in kind of metaphoric fashion with healthcare, and is actually a very incisive critique of the lack of a healthcare system in the United States. And that's fairly typical for cult television shows. I mean, Star Trek, I suppose, in particular, has this reputation for being, in a way, liberal, progressive, and doing a few message shows. But certainly, they're extraordinarily serious. They provide a realm for the discussion of the social, the philosophical, in ways that other television shows don't, in fact. Yeah.
One other characteristic that you write about is that while in an individual episode there can be a plot device and a resolution of that device, there is also the ongoing mission, if you will. There is complicating factors that extend over a whole season and indeed over years.
Well, indeed. I mean, the hallmark of television generally, particularly in the United States, is seriality. It's one episode following another, but development of characters, development of plot lines. Hill Street Blues famously is the instigator of this in the early 80s, and that's tied up with these demographic shifts I talked about. But what cult television can do, which those shows can't do, is to create a universe in which some of the reality factors don't actually govern. So on ER, Doug and Carol can have a long relationship, and it can be on again and it can be off again, and we can wonder about where it's going, but it can't unhappen. They can't not have had a relationship. Whereas on Buffy, it's possible to imagine that Buffy is actually a poor, mentally disturbed girl sitting in an asylum who's not actually the Slayer. And this is a way of, you can create alternative past, you can create alternative futures, you can create alternative presence, you can test the characters in ways that more reality-based television can't do. And that's a particular characteristic of cult telly, yeah.
With us now from his home in Southern California is the creative force behind the cult series Buffy the Vampire Slayer and its spin-off Angel, the man who married teen angst to the monster movie and dared to put a Western in space. Joss Whedon joins us, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Buffy, of course, was a movie before it was a TV show, but did you consciously set out to create something that might be interpreted as a cult?
Yeah, I would say I did. Not a cult in the sense of being exclusionary, just a cult in the sense of the kind of show that people respond to more viscerally and imaginatively than they do to just their everyday sort of decent fare.
We should point out one of the great things about both those programs, Buffy and its spin-off Angel, is the voice, if you will, of the whole show, the balance of humor with intense drama. We have a clip from a scene in Angel in which the main character, a consciousness-haunted vampire, mentally prepares himself for battle.
I'm not ready yet. Too many years spent sleeping in soft beds, living in a world where I don't belong. I can't fight them. Not yet. But soon.
Dramatic, heavy stuff, Joss Whedon, but the shows also carry a lot of laugh lines. How do you find the balance?
You know, you find it in yourself. You know, you respond. I think, you know, most writers write like fans, and when you start getting tired of the turgid, you make a joke. And when you feel like, you know, the stakes aren't high enough, you try for the heart. You find the balance just in your own conversations, and you definitely see it. Too much of one thing on the show, it makes you want to go in the other direction. And it started out as a mission statement, you know, let's have all these things happen at once, because they do happen at once, and horror makes jokes funnier. You know, I mean, if you put something in the context of I'm expecting a joke, it puts more of an onus on the joke than if you put something in the context of drama. So from the start, this is what we wanted to do, but we found, you know, that it was basically easy to balance because we found the rhythms in ourselves.
What were the models, obviously, beyond the vampire, works?
The models, I think I heard Hill Street Blues mentioned. Wise Guy was a very big model because of the villain arc concept. Not knowing if I was going to get to make more than the 12 episodes we were originally picked up for, you know, I sort of completed the villain's arc, and I knew coming into season two I didn't want the same guy to rise again and constantly be going, this time I'm really going to defeat Buffy. I mean it. No, I'm not messing with you. This time it's going to work. You know, I wanted to create a new bunch, and that was Spike and Drusilla, and then that sort of became the paradigm. Every year, you know, we found a new arc and a new basic message.
Do I hear in the background a couple of Slayers in training there?
What you hear in the background is my one-year-old son, who I am taking care of today.
Well, we'll ask him to not destroy anything vital for the next few minutes. So we're going to take a short break and return with more of your questions and phone calls. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email. Our number, the email address is totn@npr.org. We're speaking with Joss Whedon, the creator of, among other series, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and Roberta Pearson, editor of the new book Cult Television. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about why some television shows develop cult audiences and the power these programs have for both their fans and their creators. You're invited to join us, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or email us, totn@npr.org. Our guest is Roberta Pearson, editor of the new book Cult Television. She joins us this hour from Cardiff in the United Kingdom. And still with us from Southern California is Joss Whedon, creator of several cult series, including Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel. And, Joss, we have an email question for you from Eleanor in Portland, Oregon. Why do networks continue to develop cult TV shows when it so often seems like they don't appreciate the audiences that these shows draw? They aren't happy with the ratings and don't let the shows fully develop.
Wow, that's a good question, and I've been asking myself that a lot over the last few months. I think, you know, that they know there's a core audience there that will respond in a way that they won't to other shows. The biggest movies, hit movies, have all been fantasy movies. They know there's a market there, and when it works, when it really hits, it contains a lot of ancillary markets, like, you know, not a lot of people playing with their practice dolls. You know, point of order, no, I object.
Is there a Law and Order comic book?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
At least I haven't read it. It'd be pretty exciting.
There is a CSI comic book, though.
There is a CSI comic book.
There is.
They're trying to sort of push into that market, but I think that's what they're looking for. And you know, if they don't get the numbers they seek, I mean, there are plenty of dramas that fall by the wayside every year too.
Sure.
There's everything, you know. They'll throw everything at the screen because they don't actually know what they want.
Yeah. Roberta Pearson, let me put that to you. We should point out that Angel has just been canceled.
That's terrible.
Are we in a you know, is this a pendulum? Are we in a down period now, or is this a permanent decline, do you think?
Well, it's a little hard for me to tell since I'm not as ochre on with American television as I should be. I think what Joss had said about the networks trying everything is certainly the case. When I was in the States in January, I saw some clear Buffy ripoffs, including one that starred one of the Buffy stars, in fact. And clearly the idea of a kind of magical, powerful girl was something that the networks had decided that was going to work. The problem is that occasionally something comes along, and has often been said about Star Trek, it's like catching lightning in a bottle. It's a combination of the moment, it's a combination of the creative personnel, it's the way they work together, it's the way an audience responds. And there is there's something almost mystical about that. In fact, it's something which we scholars have a hard time accounting for. In fact, if I could account for it, I wouldn't be a scholar. I'd be out in L.A. earning a lot of money. So I think that most shows that get on, well, most shows don't get on air in the first place. Most
right.
shows that do get on air don't make it very far. And as Joss says, the networks just keep throwing up things in the hope that they'll work. I think there are certainly cycles. I think, I hate to say this because I have friends at Paramount now, but I think Star Trek is kind of in decline after almost 40 years. It may come back. It would be interesting to see whether Angel and Buffy have that kind of staying power and whether in 40 years or so we'll all be sitting around talking about the Whedon vision.
let's get another caller on the line. This is Tom, who's with us from Heidelberg in Germany.
Hi, I'm Tom Reese in Heidelberg, Germany, like you said, and I know that these shows are popular over here, Buffy and of course Star Trek, and I know that there are Trekkies and stuff like that. I don't know, I've never met any people that are into the cult of Buffy, but I was wondering if it's more Americans that are into the cult part of it and going to these conventions, or how popular it is in other countries. And also, a second part of the question is it maybe because Americans are so mobile in almost every aspect of their lives, do they need to latch onto a cult like a religion?
Joss Whedon, is that something you've thought about?
Well, you know, Buffy is enormously popular in Europe. In England, it's a major thing. In Germany, the soundtrack to the musical sold as much in Germany as it did in the United States. There is something about American culture that spawns these things, but they seem to speak to, I would say, more than just Americans.
Hmm.
I would say pretty much everybody, if they're actually speaking at all. A lot of genre shows are just sort of going through the motions, and here's a magic trick, and here's an alien, and here's a fight. Obviously, Star Trek was, you know, the real precursor in terms of, like, the Twilight Zone, which I think also needs to be cited as a real influence of using science fiction to really give a message, to investigate something, to talk about social mores and stuff, which people need to examine, you know, in that fantastical way, so they can really distance themselves enough from it to get into it, whether it's a social or an emotional issue. So I think that the need for fantasy is universal.
Let's get another caller in. This is Chuck in Pressat, Germany. A lot of calls from Germany today.
All right. See?
Hi. This is Chuck.
Yes, you're on the air, Chuck.
Super. I have a question for Josh. I have become a fan of Firefly sort of way after the fact. I had moved to Germany before the show ever came on, and a friend of mine back in the States sent me a couple of videotapes. And you're talking about Star Trek earlier as cult TV, and Star Trek, of course, was canceled way before its time, but sort of came back and flew again. My question for Josh is, why do you think Firefly didn't fly?
And let me preface his answer by explaining Firefly was the aforementioned Western in space, and a good thing you only got a couple of tapes, because there were only a couple of episodes.
Well, actually, I bought the DVD set, and we've got all of them, including the unaired ones.
Okay, Josh, go ahead.
First of all, you're a great man of our time. Second, why it didn't succeed on the network, it would be subject to many interpretations. Amazingly enough, mine has entirely to do with the network and nothing to do with the show. They didn't really want it. They had no faith in it. They put it in their worst slot. They refused to air the pilot. They never aired more than three in a row. They didn't advertise it. When they did advertise it, they advertised it poorly. They did everything in their power to sort of give it the stench of failure, and then they canceled it before it ever had a chance to get its footing. So it was kind of untested.
The whole thing about running the pilot, what, two episodes after
They aired it last.
Well, it was really weird. I didn't quite understand that.
Well, what happened there was very simply was a bad match. Fox wanted to be hit in the face repeatedly. That's kind of the way they make television, and some very good television. But the pilot of Firefly, Serenity, kind of took its time. It had more of a sort of slow, laconic kind of build, so you could get to know all the characters. That does not fly in the Fox universe, in their paradigm, at all. So they just couldn't understand it.
We know we have to let you go, Joss, but I have one final question, and that involves your next project, which, as I understand it, you're going on to another pretty well-developed fantasy universe. You're writing for Marvel Comics.
Well, actually, I'm doing two things right now, besides finishing Angel. One of them is that I am actually filming the movie of Firefly called Serenity. Like Star Trek, that has found a new life, which is really exciting to me. And then, yes, I am taking over one of the X-Men titles for Marvel Comics for a year, simply because that's another huge influence on me and a childhood dream.
Well, Joss Whedon, thanks very much. Good luck with both your projects and with the ongoing story of raising that one-year-old.
Thank you. Hope I didn't hear too much about that.
Joss Whedon is the creator of the cult series Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Angel, and Firefly. He joined us from his home in Southern California. And let's get another question in, and this is an email question. I believe an integral reason a show can be classified as a cult phenomenon, writes John Davis in Raleigh, North Carolina, relates to its popularity. Shows like The Simpsons and South Park have too wide an appeal to be cult. For instance, when South Park first came out, it had the makings of becoming a cult phenomenon, became too successful. But Star Trek and movies like the Rocky Horror Picture Show have significant core fans, but never had enough mass appeal, thus the cult status. What do you think, Roberta Pearson?
I think that's slightly wrong. It's a problem with the label cult. I heard Joss using the word genre television, which is really what the industry does, and that's actually, I think, what I would prefer to call it, even though the book has to be called cult television in order to sell.
I see. We all have to make our compromises, don't we?
Well, yes, that's what the marketers at any university press are very interested in shifting books. So please buy it. It'll make the University of Minnesota very happy. But I think it's somewhat of a misnomer. What we try to do is to untangle some of the definitions of cult. And in fact, one would have to look at comparative ratings. But Star Trek Next Generation was getting ratings as high as about 14 or so, which is pretty significant. That's a lot of millions of people watching it. And if you put that together all over the years, the millions of people that have watched Star Trek, certainly it's not just a core base of devoted fans. And that was something I was actually addressing earlier. It certainly is that base that gets the media attention, obviously. But I do think it does go beyond that. And I think also, at least the way that we're using the word, is to talk also about textual characteristics, the kind of things that I was saying at the beginning about the scope of the universe, the imaginative nature of that universe. So it's not just to do with audiences.
The cliché of the cult television star whose career becomes chained to one character is painfully evident in every William Shatner Priceline commercial.
Yes.
For other stars, it's more about the genre than a specific character. Actor Bruce Campbell had a recurring role in the cult series Xena Warrior Princess, as well as starring in the series Briscoe County Jr. and in Jack of All Trades. All three provided him with some pretty good one-liners.
Don't you worry, little buddy. You're dealing with a man of honor. However, honor requires a higher percentage of profit.
Of all the sawmills and all the lumber towns, why did I have to walk into hers?
Ah, you know, there's nothing like the sweet smell of a domesticated woman. And I mean that in the most respectful way.
Bruce Campbell joins us on the line now from Southern Oregon. Good of you to be with us today.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here on this distinguished panel.
You kind of get to ham it up in all of those parts. Is that some of the fun of working in a genre series?
Well, you know, I'm an actor, and everything's fake about it, so why not go for it? That's what I say.
Now, some of these programs had odd premises. Briscoe County Jr., for example, I have to admit to here one of my personal favorites. A Western, though, with some campy science fiction elements thrown in. Do you ever look at these projects and go, you know, the audience is never going to go for this?
Well, I'll tell you, I was attracted to all three for exactly those reasons, that they were not mainstream shows. With Briscoe, it was a traditional Western combined with, as you mentioned, sci-fi elements, and that's sort of the good news and bad news. The good news is 18 people really love that show. The bad news is it was quirky enough to never catch on, and so that's sort of the good news, bad news. Hercules and Xena, I think those shows really caught on because it's not a cop show. It's not a lawyer show. It's not a doctor show. You go, whoa, who's this tall woman who's kicking these people's rear ends, you know? And I think with a little bit of a gay theme, that perked up some hackles and got a little bit of people talking about certain things. So that settled into its own. That's a good example of a cult show, is Xena.
I wonder, have you ever attended any of the Xena Hercules conventions? And if you have, what's it like?
Oh, I've been to dozens of them. I think they're fascinating. I like the grassroots sort of getting in there and seeing who's watching your show, but there are several actors who worked on Xena who went to one convention. They came over from New Zealand, went to one convention in Pasadena, and it freaked them out so badly they never went to another one. Because it's people who, they know every episode, you know, they know a lot about you, at least what's been printed. They've got your photos. They've got 18 different kinds. They've got audition shots from 10 years ago, things you thought the negatives had been destroyed.
And wished they had.
Oh, it's disturbing and heartening at the same time.
Do you ever worry, though, that, you know, at age 70, you're still going to be Autolycus to a lot of people?
It's hard to say. The good news is I've had, because I've been in cult movies as well, the Evil Dead films, in my line, you'll have little kids dressed like a cowboy right next to a guy with spiked hair and piercing. So I've branched out within the cult world, but that's definitely where I operate.
So you're not expecting any offers for Lear?
Oh, no question at all. You know, but I have to say, it appeals to me. And yet that's the irony of it. The very thing that makes a small group of people so enthusiastic is the same thing that keeps it from actually running for years and years and years. Most good cult things are things that initially flopped and then were either rediscovered or held on to tightly by a fervent group of people.
Well, I'm among the 18, and Briscoe County Jr. will be back. Bruce Campbell, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bruce Campbell's television credits include Xena, Warrior Princess, Hercules, The Legendary Journeys. His most recent film was Bubba Hotep, and he joined us from Southern Oregon. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another listener on the line. David is with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi. I have a quick comment to make about the power of so-called genre television to captivate the imagination of its viewers and inspire. I was a young boy of about 8 or 10 when the original Star Trek first went into syndication. And thanks to that show, and the fact that Spock and McCoy made science look cool and the entire show made technology very interesting and compelling is what inspired me to interest in physics and computer programming. And I've had a very good living as an adult, as a technology professional, inspired by the kinds of things that show made me fall in love with.
Roberta Pearson, we sometimes forget, as David reminds us, that these programs influence real people in real ways.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. In fact, a youngish friend of mine has just got a job at NASA, where I believe half the population there are Star Trek fans, much like the chap who just phoned in. Certainly, yeah. I mean, it's had an amazing influence on me. I watched Star Trek in its first incarnation, and now I'm a fairly well-respected academic actually writing books about it, which is fairly, you know, I make a living doing this sort of thing, which is rather amazing. But yeah, it has an amazing effect on people. I think people at NASA, Whoopi Goldberg tells a famous story, in fact, about how when she was young and watching the original series, she was incredibly excited to see Nichelle Nichols playing Uhura, and said, mommy, there's a black woman on television and she's not playing a maid. And then when The Next Generation came up, Whoopi Goldberg actually asked the producers of the show if she could come on it. She wanted to do that because it had been so important to her in her life. Mae Jemison, who was the first black female astronaut, actually did a cameo on The Next Gen as well. So there are an awful lot of people out there who have been inspired by shows, particularly like by Star Trek, because it's been on for so long. But people, yes, who's it has a life-transforming experience effect on people.
David, thanks very much.
Certainly.
Before we leave, an email from Tom Eaton that we got. If we're talking about cult TV shows, let's not forget, he writes, what may be the first one, Patrick McGoohan's enigmatic series, mm-hmm. The Prisoner, aired in the summers 1968-69, which still provokes discussion and comment 35 years later. To my mind, the most intelligent of all the so-called cult TV offerings, The Prisoner explored adult themes and the tangled anxieties of the Cold War, filmed not too far from where you're speaking to us today, Roberta.
That's right, in Port Marion, and even though I don't work for the Welsh Tourist Board, I would advise everybody to visit. It's an absolutely lovely place, except I kept expecting the eyes of the statues to follow me, and they didn't.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Okay. Nice talking to you.
Roberta Pearson is the editor of Cult Television, a reader in media and cultural studies at Cardiff University. She was with us from Cardiff University in Wales. When we come back from a short break, we'll solve the mystery of the Quiznos commercials and find out exactly who this strong bad guy is that all the kids are talking about. Internet animation. Do you have a favorite flashlight? If so, give us a call. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, or you can email us at totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.